So this past week, after literally doing an hour and a half teaching, I decided that I needed to go back and change a few things around, especially the order of some of the material that was presented, and bring some clarification to some of the questions that were being asked. And so I'm going to attempt to cover what I did, what took me an hour and a half to. I'm going to try to do it all within an hour. And I've entitled this message, it's fairly long, but I'm covering three different parts. The title of this message is Angelic Falls, Jesus's Kingdom Ministry, and Stages of the Spread of the Gospel. And it's important that when we look at the New Testament and we look at what Jesus was doing and we look at the mandate that the apostles and the early Christians had, that the things that they did, the way that they ministered, the people that they ministered to, really goes back into the Old Testament background of these three angelic falls. And for some of you that have listened to this podcast or listened to stuff that we've been teaching and focusing on the last couple of years, this ground will not be unfamiliar. But I'm going to just summarize these three falls again, because in the Old Testament, many of us were taught that there was basically one fall, that Satan fell, and his fall ultimately led to what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve's fall, right? So kind of a very simplistic view of why that the world is so messed up is, well, Satan fell, and then that ultimately led to mankind's fall. But that isn't the answer that the Jews living at the time of Jesus and before he lived, and even the apostles themselves in the worldview that they had. A Second Temple Jewish mind or perspective, Second Temple Judaism being that time between the rebuilding of the temple before Christ up until its destruction in 70 AD. This is when we talk about Second Temple Judaism, that's what we're talking about. So just to start, to give a quote from, Dr. Michael Heiser, a book that he put out not so long ago, last year, called Demons: What the Bible Really Says About the Powers of Darkness, is where this quote comes from. This quote comes from: the Old Testament describes three divine rebellions, one individual, two corporate. Hostility toward the will of the Most High God began in Eden with a lone rebel. It erupted again in the days leading to the flood with the transgression of the sons of God. God's punitive rejection and division of the nations and subsequent creation of Israel as his own people precipitated the third rebellion, when the sons of God allotted to the nations went rogue. So in this one quote, we have the three angelic rebellions. The first one being the fall of Satan, which, like I alluded to earlier, or I mentioned earlier, led to the fall of Adam and Eve. This is the Genesis 3 account. Sin entered the world. So the question is, and I'll answer this for each of these falls: when did Satan fall? And according to a Christian tradition that actually is built off of a couple of verses that people put together, this isn't what the early Christians believed, but this idea, well, Satan fell sometime after God created, the heavens or whatever. Satan fell, and then he was fallen, long before he created Adam and Eve. Also, part of that narrative is that he took a third of the angels with him. This is just completely abusing a verse in Revelation chapter 12. This is not what the early Christians believed. The evidence, and I don't have the quotes here, it was outside the scope of this teaching, is that Satan fell in the garden before Adam and Eve fell. And His first sin was not pride, according to the early Christians. It was envy. He envied the relationship that Adam and Eve had with Yahweh, and that led to him. That led to his fall, and it led to their fall. All right. So anyway, I don't want to go further into that. Just to move on, there was a second angelic fall that happened in Genesis chapter 6. This is sometimes called the fall of the watchers, but you know, it talks about when the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were attractive, and you have these angelic beings coming down and, you know, producing the offspring that are called the Nephilim, or some translations call them giants, in Genesis 6, right before the flood. And so sin entered the world in Genesis 3, and then this fall, this angelic incursion into the affairs of mankind led to corruption to such a degree that it led to the flood, right? So when did this fall take place? Well, right before the flood in Genesis chapter 6. The one that's a little bit harder for people to see and discern is this third angelic fall, which starts really with the Genesis 11, 1 through 9, the Tower of Babel incident, where God is judging the nations. He confuses the languages, and he scatters the people, confuses their ability to communicate. But what we see from Deuteronomy 32, which I'll get into in just a minute, a couple of verses, and also Psalm 82, these three passages are all related: Genesis 11, Deuteronomy 32, and Psalm 82. And the fact that modern Bible commentators and scholars and theologians do not see this connection is only because they are literally reading their Old Testaments outside of the context from the people in which it was given, because these three passages were interconnected in terms of their understanding of what happened. And we see that the early Christians, after in the early Christian centuries, the commentators and the theologians in the early church also had this understanding, which I believe they clearly got from the apostles. And so, you know, fast forward 2,000 years, and we don't even see that there was a third angelic fall that is being described in these passages. So what happened in Genesis chapter 11, obviously, is that there was the disinheritance of the nations. It was the judgment of God that was put on to the people there at the Tower of Babel. Before that event, because of the covenant with Noah, all of Noah's descendants were in covenant with God, but that was broken at this point. And what we see here, and that covenant goes back to Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. But anyway, what we have in Genesis 11 is that this is a judgment of God, and he's disinheriting the nations. And from amongst the nations, he calls Abram out of Mesopotamia, and he calls his own inheritance, which is, you know, ultimately will become Israel. And he disinherits the nations, right? So what happened? All right. So the people at this time were put under it says the gods of the nations. I'm going to read the passage out of Deuteronomy 32. It says, Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God, or as the Septuagint has it, according to the number of the angels of God. But the Lord's portion, verse 9, 32, 9, the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. So Deuteronomy 32 is a commentary. It's referencing what happened in Genesis chapter 11, right? Now, what we find as we get into Psalm 82 is that these angels, these sons of God, these angelic beings that were overseeing the nations, they also fell. We don't know when they fell, but all we do know is that they fell. And I'll get into Psalm 82 in just a minute. So here's a commentary on this passage. What about the divine perspective? While Israel is condemned for worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, there is no indication in the Old Testament that the sons of God allotted to the nations at Babel were fallen when that assignment took place. So this commentator is saying that when God put mankind under the, you know, under these sons of God as their judgment, when he disinherited the nations, there's just no indication biblically that those angels were fallen at that time, that they actually had an assignment to govern and to oversee the people that were under judgment with righteousness and with justice, but ultimately they fell. All right. Let me go back to Deuteronomy 32, some more commentary. Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9 informs us that the act of judgment enacted on humanity at Babel resulted not only in dividing and scattering them, but assigning them to members of Yahweh's heavenly host council. Again, so much of the Old Testament narrative doesn't make sense if you don't have an understanding of what was the divine council. Again, that's outside the scope of this talk to go into that. It informs Genesis. It informs so much of the Old Testament. It informs the book of Job, the prologue to the book of Job. What was this divine council that Yahweh had? Who were the members of the divine council? Anyway, some more commentary. In terms of the human perspective, while Yahweh's judgment was harsh, this is referring to this disinheriting the nations at Babel. It was not final. When God chose to raise up a new human family, Israel, in the wake of the Babel event, he left room for the salvation of the forsaken nations in the covenant with Abram. It would be through Abram's descendants that all the nations of the earth would be blessed, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. The promise would, of course, ultimately be fulfilled in Christ, Galatians 3, 16. Now the promises that were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say to his offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one, and to your offspring, who is Christ. So prior to the coming of the promised ones, Gentiles had to join themselves to Israel, forsaking other gods to be in right relationship to the true God, Israel. Israel was to be a kingdom of priests bearing witness to the goodness of life with Yahweh as their God. But there was no overt attempt to evangelize the inhabitants of the nations. They were under judgment. So that's kind of a summary of, so it, the nations get disinherited. The Noah's covenant was, you know, essentially null and void at that point. They're under judgment. Yahweh takes for himself his own people, you know, starting by calling Abram out of from the nations, out of Mesopotamia. But people still had a way to join into covenant with God. It was just a bit difficult, you know, things like circumcision for males, even adults. So what about the corruption of these gods, you know, that these sons of God that were these angels that were put over the nations? So I'm going to read basically quickly through Psalm 82. Unfortunately, many modern commentators don't read Psalm 82 correctly, and they don't realize that these gods that are talked about in Psalm 82 are actually references to these sons of God, these angelic beings. They somehow view it all through a human interpretation. Also the same with Genesis 6. They don't view that angels took human wives and had an offspring. They view that, oh, the sons of Seth were these one group of men, and they took wives from another group of men. So they completely misinterpret the entire narrative of the Old Testament, because rather than having a supernatural worldview, the worldview, mind you, that the Jesus and his apostles had, that Second Temple Jews had, it's only hundreds of years later that Christian commentators began to misinterpret and to, you know, what the Old Testament was saying on all of these points. Anyway, so I'm getting to Psalm 82, because Psalm 82 is a commentary on the fall of these gods that oversaw the nations. So verse 1, God, Elohim, has taken his place, stand in the divine council. I already told you that the Old Testament has this concept of God's, Yahweh's divine council. And here it is mentioned in Psalm 82. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. So the same word for God, Yahweh, the same word is Elohim. And then later in the same verse, it says God's plural Elohim, he holds judgment. So again, this goes into another matter in the Old Testament where sometimes Yahweh is referred to as Elohim. And sometimes when Elohim is used, it's referring plural to the sons of God, these angelic beings. And, you know, it just depends. You have to interpret the context of each verse. And right here in one verse, in Psalm 82, verse 1, you have Elohim used in one case for Yahweh and another case for these gods or these sons of gods or these angels that he holds judgment. So verses 2 through 5 describe their corruption. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. So this is describing that they fell. They had a job to do. Yahweh gave these angels a job to do, which was to basically oversee these, you know, sons of Adam that were under judgment around the world, but they didn't. He says, verse 6, I said you are gods, sons of the Most High. So I say you are Elohim, sons of the Most High. This is Beni Elion, you know, sons of the Most High. All of you, nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, verse 8, arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. So right here, they fell and they were created. These sons of God, these angelic beings were created immortal. And yet their judgment is that they fell, and like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. So here's some more commentary on this verse. The gods charged with the rule of the nations became corrupt administrators, and in so doing sowed chaos in the heavenly realm as well. Yahweh created a world characterized by righteousness and well-being. In Psalm 82, the gods are condemned to death for their failure to carry out justice in the human realm. And so again, you just have to see that Psalm 82 is related to Deuteronomy 32, which is related to Genesis 11. These are all passages that are related. And sometimes we read our Bibles and we don't see, oh, that's referring to that, or this is referring to that. This is actually the worldview and the exegesis, if you want to use a big term, how you rightly interpret the Bible. This was the worldview and the exegesis of these passages that was held by Second Temple Judaism, by the apostles, the early Christians, all right? Let's go on with some more commentary. The concept that the nations of the world were allotted to lesser gods as a punishment at Babel, and that those gods sowed chaos on the earth and were hostile to Yahweh and his people, can be seen in a variety of Second Temple texts. So when we look at the different, these would be extra biblical, these would be commentaries, these would be other writings from the Second Temple Jewish period, Second Temple Judaism, that this idea that the nations were, you know, being governed by these angels and that they fell, and that this was actually something that perverted mankind even further, was seen in their different writings. God disinherited humanity, the Gentiles, I'm going on with the commentary, at the Babel event, assigning the nations to lesser gods, angels or sons of God, who sowed chaos amongst their charge. The notion, here we go, the notion that the different nations were allotted to different gods or heavenly beings was widespread in the ancient world. In Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9, more commentary, we read that when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of men, he fixed the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. The origin of this idea is to be sought in the ancient Near Eastern concept of Yahweh's divine counsel. All right, so here is a couple of Second Temple Judaism texts that are commentaries on them. The book of Sirach. Sirach reaffirms Deuteronomy 32, where it says this: he appointed a ruler over every nation, but Israel is the Lord's own portion. So Sirach was this Second Temple Judaism text that we actually find in the Septuagint. And the commentary of it, it's Sirach 17:17, reaffirms this understanding of Deuteronomy 32, kind of like a commentary, right? Another Second Temple Judaism text was called the Animal Apocalypse, part of First Enoch. And here's what it says: in the Animal Apocalypse, the angels or gods of the nations are represented by 70 shepherds to whom Israel is handed over. Again, more commentary from that period on these texts. The point of Paul's declaration, some more commentary, is that the ruling authority of the gods allotted to the nations, this is Deuteronomy 32, was declared illegitimate and null by the work of Christ. See, you don't, it's hard to understand what Jesus was doing in the Gospels and what the apostles were doing when we get, you know, to their ministry after Jesus, you know, was ascended to heaven, if you don't understand the narrative of the Old Testament. So Paul is declaring that the ruling authority of the gods of the nations was now illegitimate and null and void because of the work of Christ. In the past, prior to Christ, the Most High had allotted the nations to the sons of God. Their authority was legitimate because they had been appointed by the true God. They were supposed to be in their positions. Psalm 82 tells us that those gods, the sons of the Most High, Psalm 82, 6, rebelled, became corrupt, and instead of ruling their people according to the sort of justice God desired, they enslaved them and ultimately becoming the objects of their worship and seducing Yahweh's own people into idolatry. Now, however, because of the cross, their rule has no legitimacy. So all of these angelic falls that I just summarized quite quickly, the first two, and went more into the third one because I think it's the one people are most unfamiliar with. When we begin to look at the ministry of Jesus, we need to look at it in the context that Jesus came to the planet, and what he was doing is he was undoing the effects of these three angelic falls. All right? So the nature, this next section I'm calling the nature and the scope of Jesus' kingdom ministry, in which he reverses the effects of the fall of Satan that led to the fall of Adam and Eve, the fall in Genesis 6, the fall of the watchers, and the perversion that they brought to mankind. And I have to tell you, I didn't get into it here, but if you get into Second Temple Judaism and the commentaries about what happened in Genesis 6, there's passage after passage after passage talking about what was the nature of the evil that came into the world in Genesis 6 that led to the flood. And then we have this other corruption after the fall of after the Tower of Babel judgment and all of the mankind being put under the governance of these angels that seemingly at the time were righteous and were loyal to Yahweh. But what happened is that, and you know, just in a short summary, I had a lot of commentary about this, or I just read a lot of commentary about this. But what happened was, is that these angels that were put over the nations, instead of governing the people and literally pointing them to Yahweh, they actually were worshipped and they fell. And so really the fall of after the increase of evil after the Tower of Babel was this worldwide idolatry. And if you look around the world and you look at all of the false religions all around the world, what you have is you have the remnants of this fall. So you go to India and they have all of these gods, they call them gods, and that whatever, you know, if you just take this, if you take the biblical story and apply it to what happened in India, what happened in India is that you had sons of God that were over that region of the world at that time. And rather than point people to the worship of the one true God, these angels, all of a sudden, mankind began to worship them. And rather than tell them to repent and no, I'm just an angel, I'm just a creature, just like you, no, what they did is they received it, they fell. And you can describe, literally, you have an explanatory power to explain any false religion in the world, basically going back to what happened after Genesis chapter 11 and the Tower of Babel incident. So we come to Jesus's ministry, and I just want to say that I wasn't taught this when I first became a Christian. I was basically taught that, you know, the only fall that matters in the Old Testament is that Satan fell and he led to Adam and Eve's fall, and Jesus came and basically we had a broken relationship with God. We were kicked out of the garden. We had no longer, sin entered the world. Sin was a problem. Jesus came to solve the one fall, the one problem. All right. And he did. He did come to solve the problem that started in the Garden of Eden. Yes, he did come. I mean, obviously that was a huge part of Jesus's kingdom ministry, and the reason he came to the planet was to restore what happened, the fall in the garden, right? But he also came to undo the falls that happened in Genesis 6 and the fall of the sons of God allotted to the nations in Genesis chapter 11 as well. He came to undo all three angelic falls, and how these three angelic falls sowed chaos on the earth, sowed chaos among the sons and daughters of Adam, and completely screwed up, literally just completely screwed up the natural order, even as it screwed up the supernatural order. I mean, there were these angels were created good, and they were loyal to Yahweh, and many of them fell. And so the heavens and the earth got screwed up. You know, essentially, all the realms. And all of the problems that we have in the world today are related to these three falls. All right? So when we get to the ministry of Jesus, Jesus comes into the world, and what we see him doing, and again, I've covered this in so much more detail in other teachings, I want to get to some other aspects and elements and some things I want to focus on. But he came to preach, he came to heal, and he came to cast out demons. And if you begin to look at Jesus' ministry, and he came as the only begotten, the one and only, the unique Son of Yahweh, the unique Son of the Father. He came as the unique Son of God to come and to restore the fallen sons and daughters of Adam, right? And to preach, to heal, and to cast out demons. All right. So I want to look at this because, I mean, we're all familiar with his preaching ministry. Obviously, this continues on. We preach the gospel, the good news. We preach about what Jesus is, his atoning work, what he came to, you know, but we've taken a far more complicated, complex ministry. And it's like we've just narrowed it down to one little element and aspect. And I get it. Other Christians and different denominations or different parts of the church, they focus more on the healing, and others focus on the casting out of demons. But Jesus's ministry was holistic, and he was coming to address the effects of these three falls. All right. Now, where do demons come from? I want to hit on this because a lot of people, they conflate the Old Testament. If you ask some Christians, they'll say, well, where do demons come from? Well, demons are fallen angels. Well, that's not actually true. Fallen angels are fallen angels. Satan was a fallen angel. Those angels that came down in Genesis 6 are fallen angels. The sons of God that fell after Genesis 11, and became the gods of Psalm 82 that fell like princes and were going to die like men. Those also were fallen angels after they fell, right? But demons are disembodied spirits. So where did they come from? Well, the Second Temple Judaism, so the Jews that lived before the time of Jesus into and after the time of Jesus, the apostles themselves, we see this written, it's mentioned in the New Testament as well, believed that that demons were the disembodied spirits of the dead Nephilim or the dead giants. So the offspring of Genesis 6 were the Nephilim in the land, these giants, right? And once they died, once the giants, these hybrid died, at that point, they were disembodied spirits and they roamed around, and these are the origin of demons. Now, you say, that sounds strange. Where does this idea come from? I'm going to show you that this was the entire position of the early church. I'm also going to show you that it was the position of the Jews living before Jesus. So Justin Martyr, he writes in the second century, he writes this. I'm just quoting him. The angels transgressed this appointment and were captivated by love of women. This is Genesis 6. And they beget children who are those who are called demons. So here we have in AD 160, a major Christian leader, Justin Martyr, writes that the children of, you know, the giants, you know, that they were the children of this angelic human offspring. They were the offspring of this angelic human union, and they are the ones that we are called demons. All right. So also in the second century, another Athenagoras was his name, about 175 AD. He said this: those angels then who have fallen from heaven, this is Genesis 6, and haunt the air and the earth, and are no longer able to rise to heavenly beings, and the souls of the Nephilim, or giants, who are the demons who wander about the world, perform similar actions. All right? So he's talking about the angels, the fallen angels, in the first part of his quote, and the souls of the giants, or the souls of the Nephilim, who are the demons who wander about the earth, they also perform similar actions. All right? So again, we have a difference here, right here, between the fallen angels and between demons. Furthermore, we are instructed, I'm now Tertullian, almost around the year 200, the very end of the second century. Furthermore, we are instructed by our sacred books how from certain angels, Genesis 6, who fell of their own free will, there sprang a more wicked demon brood, condemned of God along with the authors of their race. Their great business is the ruin of mankind, so that from the start, spiritual wickedness sought our destruction. Accordingly, they inflict upon our bodies diseases and other grievous calamities, and by violent assaults, they hurry the soul into sudden and extraordinary excesses by an influence equally obscure. Demons and angels breathe into their soul and rouse up its corruptions with furious passions and vile excesses. Right? So here we have Tertullian differentiating between demons that were they were the offspring of these angels that fell. All right? And it's when these embodied Nephilim giants died, when these hybrid, the offspring of this union, when they died, their disembodied spirits became what we call demons, or in the New Testament, unclean spirits. Why are they called unclean spirits in the New Testament? That's the normal term that's used when you talk about Jesus casting out these demons was unclean spirits. And the reason that they were called that was because they were the offspring of this union between angels and human women. That's why they were called unclean. That was such a perversion. It was such a violation of God's order. They were called unclean. This also answers the questions why there's no redemption for them. These demons are more wicked demon brood, right? They are completely condemned of God. You know, somebody asked me recently, why weren't these giants provided a savior or given an opportunity to repent? They're just created because of where they came from. They you know, because of their, you know, their origin in this sin of the watchers and the human women, they were more wicked and they were completely condemned of God. Anyway, I go on. Origen, in this third century, he writes, in my opinion, it is certain wicked demons, so to speak, of the race of the Titans or the giants, who have been guilty of impiety towards the true God and toward the angels in heaven. They have fallen from it. They haunt the denser part of bodies. They also frequent unclean places on the earth. Since they are without bodies of earthly material, disembodied spirits, I told you, they possess some power of foretelling future events, so they engage in the works of this kind, desiring to lead the human race away from the true God. They are also secretly entering the bodies of the more predatory, savage, and wicked of animals. So they're talking about demons that actually inhabit, you know, animals and stir them up to do whatever they choose, whenever they choose. They can turn the fancies of these animals to make flights and movements of various kinds in order to entrap men by such power of divination. So again, Origen, following Tertullian, following Justin Martyr, they all had this same view, is that fallen angels were fallen angels, and the demons are the disembodied spirits of the dead giants that we find after Genesis chapter 6, all right? A couple more quotes from the early church. Among angels, some are angels of God, and others are angels of the devil, all right? So there are still angels that are loyal to Yahweh. You know, we can think of Gabriel and Michael, and these are named angels, but the angels that are still loyal, and other angels are of the devil, those that have fallen. Either they fell in Genesis 6, or they fell after Genesis 11. But among demons, there is no such distinction, for they are all said to be wicked. All right? So it's very interesting. Here Origen differentiates again between angels and demons. So anybody that tells you that demons are fallen angels is conflating two completely different categories of creatures. Two completely different categories. But again, it's because they don't read their Bibles in the context of the people that received it. They don't read their Bibles in the context and the understanding, the worldview of the apostles and their successors in the second, third, and fourth century. And so what we have is we have people 2,000 years later that are misreading their Old Testament and misinterpreting, misunderstanding that demons and fallen angels are totally two different categories. And finally, Commodianus in the third century as well, another Christian, just another commentator. From the seed of the fallen angels and women, giants are said to have been born. Again, here's Genesis 6. By them, arts were made known to the earth. Okay, this gets into some of the commentary of what happened in Genesis 6. It's beyond the scope here, but anyway, this quote mentions a couple. They taught the dyeing of wool and everything that is done. When they died, men erected images to them. So when they died, these giants, when they died, men erected images to them. Yet because they were of an evil seed, irredeemable, the Almighty did not approve of their being brought back from death. When they had died, for that reason they wander, and they now subvert many bodies, and it is these whom you pagans presently worship and pray to as gods, right? Now, here you see that this early Christian writer is also differentiating between angels and demons. Here at the end, however, I told you that before the gods of the nations were worshipped, he also believes that some people pray and worship to some demons as well. So he seems to be mixing and matching a little bit at the end of his quote here between angels and demons in terms of pagans' response to them. All right, so let's move on. I think I've established that it was not just one or two held this view. It was the universal view of the early Christians that what happened in Genesis 6 was the explanation for why we have demons and unclean spirits in the Gospels. Now, another thing is, what about the origin of sickness? Okay? Because it was a common belief in Second Temple Judaism, and it was a common belief amongst the early Christians, and we see it in the life and the ministry of Jesus, that demons were one of the causes of disease. Now, I should say that, and just to be clear, demons are not the only reason that there's sickness and disease in the world. It's also believed, and I'm going to show you, the early Christians believed, one, that demons could cause sickness, but also that there's sickness in the world because we live in a fallen world. So some people want to say, okay, if demons cause sickness, then every sickness must be caused by a demon, therefore we'll, right? And that's just not the total picture. But there was a belief in Second Temple Judaism and amongst the early Christians that demons cause disease. Now, interestingly, it wasn't until centuries later that Christians started to blame God as the cause of disease, as the author of disease. I'll get to that later, or a little bit later. But anyway, I just want to say that we also are living in a fallen world which is full of sickness and disease that is not caused by demons, right? It's caused because we live in a fallen world. Now, it does go back to the three falls that were mentioned in the Old Testament, and sin entering the world, and through sin, death came into the world, and death and disease and corruption. So it really does go back to that first fall more than the others. That's where sickness and death entered the world. So that is one of the reasons. But later, these disembodied spirits of the dead giants also were afflicting disease on mankind. This is something they got involved in as part of, you know, part of their demonic fun, I guess you could call it that. Anyway, so what about the view before the time of Jesus? So the Second Temple Jewish view of the origin of sickness and demons. I'm just going to quote a couple of their sources. One coming from the book of Jubilees. Again, this is also in the Septuagint. It was found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we acted, I'm just quoting, and we acted in accord with all of his words. All of the evil ones who were cruel, we bound in the place of judgment, but a tenth of them we let remain so that they might be subject to Satan upon the earth. This is all commentary reference to the fall of the watchers in Genesis 6. Here's the verse, here's the part, not the verse, the line I wanted to read. And the healing of all of their illnesses together with their seductions, we told Noah that he might heal by means of herbs of the earth. So this commentary is about that at the time, you know, sicknesses were starting to be afflicted by these fallen angels and their offspring, the that became the demons. And so it's saying that God allowed Noah to actually start to understand how that we can bring healing, right, to counteract who was causing the illnesses. Anyway, I just wanted to show you the connection. Here's a commentary on the Old Testament. Now, Mastema is the name of a fallen angel in intertestamental Judaism, or Second Temple Judaism. Anyway, he's kind of like a Satan figure. Mastema required assistance in his work of corrupting and afflicting humanity. The key item to observe is the reference to healing. Again, this is back to Jubilee, the passage I just read out of the book of Jubilee. Vanderkam, who is a scholar of Second Temple Judaism and intertestamental Judaism, explains, one way the spirits harmed humans was by causing diseases. So God ordered the angels to teach Noah medicines to counteract their influence. I go on with the commentary. The Second Temple Jewish mind saw a clear connection between illness and demonic activity. This consequentially blurred the line between healing and exorcism. And as we have seen, the overlap is discernible in the Gospels. All right. What I want you to see now as we move into the New Testament is that so oftentimes in the life and the ministry of Jesus, there's healing and deliverance and exorcism that were taking place, right? So here's some of the data from the New Testament that links demons and sickness and healing altogether in terms of the ministry of Jesus. I just want you to see that because of the worldview of the Old Testament, that they saw that demons were one of the causes of sickness, you all of a sudden, Jesus's ministry of healing and casting out demons, he's undoing the influence and the effects of what happened in Genesis chapter 6 and the offspring and the influence of the demonic or the unclean spirits. In Luke 13:11, we have a reference to a spirit of infirmity, right? A spirit, another translation says, a sickness caused by a spirit, all right? That's another way to translate that expression, a spirit of infirmity, a sickness caused by a spirit, all right? Listen to this. This is the commission in Matthew chapter 10. And he called to his 12 disciples and he gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. Thus the 12 went out, instructing them, go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and proclaim to them as you go, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, and cast out demons. Again, if you go back to this original mandate, he gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal. Again, the connection between healing and casting demons is just, it's interconnected in the Gospels. Somehow we separate them, we tear it apart, but I want you to see in this, you know, you have to see that they are connected, and they are connected because of what is the origin, who is causing the sickness in the minds of the early Christians, sicknesses. And again, I have all those commentaries in the second and the third century, all of them saying one of the things that demons do, these disembodied spirits of the dead giants, one of the things they do is they afflict people with sickness. But we've been given authority over unclean spirits, them. We have not been given authority over fallen angels. This is another huge error in the church where you have people that are going around commanding principalities and powers. These were the fallen angels. We have been given authority over unclean spirits, not over second heaven fallen principalities and powers. We do not have that authority. We were not given that authority. Our mandate was over unclean spirits. We have authority over demons. Now, we can pray for God to deal with fallen principalities, but we have not been given authority over them. That is a very, very important teaching, and a lot of people have gotten into a lot of danger, spiritual danger, because they go around commanding principalities and powers that they were not given authority over. Let's go into Luke chapter 8. Soon afterwards, Jesus went through all of the cities and the villages, proclaiming and bringing the good news of the gospel of the kingdom. And the 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities. Again, and then Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, right? So again, the connection between evil spirits and sicknesses in Luke chapter 8. I have another reference from Luke chapter 7. In that hour, he healed many of diseases and plagues and evil spirits. And on many who were blind, he bestowed sight. Again, the connection between the role of the demons and disease, all right? So healing and deliverance, healing and exorcism were like two sides to the same coin. Sometimes people today, well, I have a healing ministry, and other people in the charismatic side, well, I have a ministry of exorcism, but they don't realize that these ministries in the life and the ministry of Jesus were interconnected. You couldn't just separate them, all right? Now, what about the early Christian view of the origin of sickness, okay? So I told you that in the Old Testament, in the time of the Old Testament, the evidence we have is that sicknesses, I quoted above the book of Jubilees, that the we see sickness was something that these fallen angels and their offspring, the that became the demons, that they were afflicting mankind with, and God in response began to, you know, there was a mandate of healing. Yahweh was the healer in the Old Testament, and so we have that dynamic going on where God is the healer. And then what we have in the New Testament is Jesus now going about casting out demons and healing, all right? But what you're also going to see is that amongst early Christians, I'm going to read some of their writings right now, they both attribute sickness to the demons and to living in a fallen world. So here's the first one. Clement of Alexandria, major Christian leader in around the year 200. Disease, accident, and death come upon the spiritual man too, right? So here's just a, we live in a world where disease and accident and death all affect Christians as well as non-Christians. I, again, I think that quote just shows we live in a world where everybody is affected by the fall. Now, Tertullian, writing about the same time, says this: their business, the demons, is the ruin of mankind. So from the start, spiritual wickedness sought our destruction. Accordingly, now listen to this. I quoted this earlier, but I didn't emphasize this. They inflict upon our bodies diseases and other grievous calamities. So here you have an early Christian writer that is saying that one of the things that demons do is they inflict diseases on our bodies. All right? That same writer, Tertullian, writes, the demons, I'm quoting him again, no doubt they are very kind too in regard to the healing of diseases. For first of all, they make you ill. Then to get a miracle out of it, they withdraw their hurtful influence that supposedly then they have brought a cure. So he's again attributing sickness, demonic, these demons that are the disembodied spirits of the dead Nephilim, they afflict us with illness, and then they'll turn around and they will cause a healing, they will withdraw it, and they will think that they've done a miracle. Again, just to keep people deceived and away from the one true God, right? Cyprian, major church leader in the third century, the disease of the eyes, the attacks of fevers, and the feebleness of all the limbs is common to us Christians with others, so long as this common flesh of ours is borne by us in the world. So here's another early Christian that says, that's saying, again, like I said, not all disease is caused by demons. Some of the disease, he says, the disease of the eyes, the attacks of fevers, and the feebleness of all of our limbs is common as long as this common flesh of ours is born by us in the world. We live in a fallen world, and because of that, disease and sickness are a part of the world that we live in. And finally, Lactantius. Again, Lactantius was the tutor, spiritual tutor of the Emperor Constantine in the fourth century, early fourth century. He said this: demons, they slink into the bodies of men. So he's talking about these disembodied spirits secretly working in their inner parts. They corrupt the health of these persons, bringing on diseases. They terrify their souls with dreams, harass their minds with frenzies. They do this so that by these evils they may cause men to come to them for aid. Again, keeping people away from the Lord. So you see, for the first three centuries of the Christian era, clearly a disease, you know, understanding that demons that were still around in the world, they weren't gone after, you know, some people today think, well, after the ministry of Jesus, that these demons were all, you know, whatever. There's no problem with demons on the earth anymore. You know, because of the death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus, the demonic problem was dealt with. Then why in the world are Christians in the second and the third century still talking about demons that are causing people sickness? And why is it that the church in the second and third century still had exorcism ministry going full steam ahead? Why was that ministry still around after the apostles died if there was no demons that needed to be cast out? Great question. So what happened later? And I think there was two things that happened. The later Christian view of sickness You get in the late 4th century, in the early 5th, most of his writing that would have reflected this would have been in the early 5th century, was the great Saint Augustine. And this is what he said: in some sense, God wills everything that happens. So in the early church and in Second Temple Judaism, sickness was bad. Sickness was part of the fall. Sickness was something that Jesus came to heal. And in the fifth century now, it's God's will. He goes on to say this. This is again another quote from Augustine. We must understand that even though God doesn't always give us what we want, he always gives us what we need for our salvation. And then another quote of Augustine: what grace is meant to do is to help good people not to escape their sufferings, but to bear with them with a stout heart, with a fortitude that finds its strength in faith. And again, the shift theologically was, rather than people understanding that we live in a fallen world where Satan has authority and power and his demons have some authority and power, we've been given authority to come against that authority and that power. But all of a sudden, from the fifth century onward, everything is God's will, God's sovereignty, God's control, God's omnipotence. And the reformers took that view, and much of Christianity has been infected to this day. Well, it's just God's will, you know? What happens, it happens. Anyway, so that is the later Christian view of sickness. I think you can also say that once there was this monastic movement and the monasteries and the monks and they wanted to suffer as Christ suffered, they began to view sickness as something desirable as well. That's a different trajectory and a different thing going on. But clearly, the theology that Augustine brought into the church and popularized and infected Christian, at least Western Christianity with, about sickness and God's will, is still with us to this day. All right, let's move on. So now what I want to do is I want us to look, really all of that backdrop, the ministry of Jesus, the three falls, was to look at how there were three stages of the gospel expanding. Okay, now we can see it in a bud form in the life and ministry of Jesus, which I will, when I start each point, that I'm going to get to, I will highlight what Jesus did, and then I will show that what happens in the book of Acts after that is actually, you know what? I think what I'm going to do here is I'm going to stop this. I'm going to make this part one, and then I'm going to do this as part two. There's just so much here. So part one here is the three falls of the angelic falls, and the second is to show briefly in the life and the ministry of Jesus, this kingdom ministry. I didn't go deeply into it because I think we've covered it with so much depth, and it's such a focus of what we have taught and what we are going after. So the first two parts of this talk were the three falls and the kingdom ministry of Jesus, which was to undo those three falls. And then the part I'm just going to get to in a minute here, or I'm going to follow, part two of this message will be the three stages of the gospel expanding in the book of Acts.